Okay. Welcome to everyone who's gathered for our share this evening. We're talking about an incredibly important topic and quite a controversial topic, and that is the question of risking Israeli soldiers' lives in an effort to reduce Arab civilian casualties. And to introduce our incredibly difficult topic, we're going to discuss three tragic scenarios and quite different scenarios that have arisen over the past number of years in the conflict that the Israelis have had with the Arabs. One will be Jenin, the fighting that took place in the spring of 2002. You'll recall that early 2002, the terrorist attacks were becoming more and more serious, culminating in a terrible attack on the Park Hotel during the Seder on Pesach of 2002. At that point, the Israeli government decided to launch Operation Defensive Shield, and they attacked, trying to attack the epicenter of the Palestinian terrorist movement, especially in Jenin and its refugee camp. At that point, when Israel was attacking the refugee camp in Jenin, it had a choice. It could have attacked from the air, just bombed the center of the terrorist activity from the air, or it could have gone house to house. The decision was made by the Israeli defense minister at that point that Israel would go in by foot, and unfortunately 13 Israeli soldiers died by going on foot. Highly unlikely that these 13 young men would have been killed had Israel attacked from the air. That's scenario number one. Scenario number two, moving ahead a few years, in southern Lebanon of two summers ago in 2006, the Hezbollah are attacking us, and the Hezbollah are based in southern Lebanon. And the question would be, how does one deal the Israeli army was facing two possibilities. Either they just could have carpet bombed southern Lebanon and they would have attacked, and they would have been able to eliminate the terrorists, the Hezbollah presence in southern Lebanon, or they could have gone in by attack by foot. They did choose to attack by foot after a minor attack from the air, and unfortunately, more than 100 young men were killed in this battle. And we know that the fighting in southern Lebanon wound up being not so successful. As opposed to Jenin, the operation was successful. A different scenario, third one, just to introduce the topic, is one which is not quite like the ones we described, but one that I heard from a rabbi, Rav Yuval Sherlow, interesting, very leading rabbi in Israel, who also served as an officer in the Israeli army and served as a consultant, an ethical consultant, a lot of consultants to the Israeli army. And he was called up by the Israeli army with the following scenario, that an unmanned plane has spotted a terrorist, someone that the Israelis know will be attacking. Would be attacking in a major terrorist attack within a day or two. They spotted him, very dangerous terrorist, and as they were about to spot him and to fire at him, he heard the plane hovering above, and he slipped into a taxi cab. So the question was, would it be acceptable for the Israeli army to bomb the taxi cab and eliminate the terrorists, but thereby also eliminating the driver of the taxi and perhaps the passengers as well? So these very serious moral halachic dilemmas what we're going to be discussing this evening. And we'll begin with a discussion of a classical discussion you'll see in the handout with the incident we have in Tanakh of Shimon and Levi at Shechem. We find after Dina was abducted in Shechem, and her abductors were the mayor's son as well as the mayor were not willing to let her go, and as a result, Shimon and Levi launched their attack on the mayor's son, and Shem, the rapist, and Hamor, the father, the mayor of the town. And in the process, in that fighting, Shimon and Levi not only killed the direct perpetrators, but they also killed all of the males in the town of Shechem. And this would be the point of, this can be our point of departure for discussing civilian casualties, because Shimon and Levi killed the male residents of Shechem, who at first glance appeared to be non-combatants. And the question is that considered to be acceptable or not considered to be acceptable? Do they act properly? Do they not act properly? And then we'll see if there are any relevance of this discussion, the behavior of Shimon and Levi at Shechem, to the scenarios that we described above. Now, there's a major dispute amongst the Rishonim how one evaluates Shimon and Levi's behavior. The Rambam and Ramban disagree. The Rambam believes that Shimon and Levi were entirely justified. Why? Because the Rambam argues that all the residents of Shechem, by the fact that their leaders, by the fact that the people of Shechem tolerated their leaders abducting a young Jewish girl and not freeing her, they are held accountable for the actions done by their leaders. This is an incredibly important point. The Rambam believes that the residents of an area are responsible for the actions of their leaders. So argues the Rambam. The Ramban disagrees with the Rambam, and he believes that Shimon and Levi acted improperly. And Shimon and Levi, the Ramban is critical of them on two levels. First of all, he says that who authorized Shimon and Levi to attack and to punish the people of Shechem, even if they were in violation of the obligation of Bnei Noach, of Noachites, of all human beings, to establish moral courts, dinim, moral, decent, fair courts that will judge people who are committing crimes. The Ramban says that who said that these people are, that these people would be considered to be morally accountable for the the Ramban believes that Shimon and Levi had no right to attack. They, even if the people of Shechem were guilty, they had no right, they had no authority to punish the people of Shechem. That's number one. Number two, the Ramban is critical by saying that that the people of Shechem themselves are not held morally accountable for the actions of Shimon. The people of Shechem are not held morally accountable for the actions of their leaders, because the residents of a town simply don't have that kind of power. The leaders are the ones holding the power, and the people who reside in that locale cannot be held accountable for the actions of their leaders. The people of the town would be considered to be anusim, that they don't have a choice. So obviously the Rambam disagrees about this point. Now let's try to figure out who would be considered to be correct, the Rambam or the Ramban. We take a look, see further in Sefer Bereishit, and see what the Chumash believes regarding Shimon and Levi. So at the end of the episode, we find that Yaakov says to Shimon and Levi, he's critical of the brothers. He said that you've created a serious problem, because now all the other people in the land of Canaan will hear about this, and they'll gather upon us, and they will destroy us. And we're very few. We won't be able to stand up to all the residents of Canaan. Very interesting. So we see that Yaakov is critical of the actions of Shimon and Levi. So perhaps we can see that this is a solid proof to Ramban that Shimon and Levi behaved improperly. On the other hand, this is not a rock solid proof, because we find that the story of Shimon and Levi's attack on Shechem concludes with Shimon and Levi's response to their father. Shimon and Levi replied to their father, "Hachazana yaseh hachosenu. Are we going to just let our sister be treated as a zona? to be treated as a harlot? How can we tolerate such a thing? And what's critically important in this in their response is the fact that the Chumash gives the last word to Shimon and Levi. So it would seem that the Chumash is siding with Shimon and Levi. Yaakov does not respond. Perhaps Yaakov agrees with this argument of Shimon and Levi. So perhaps Shimon and Levi were justified in what they did. So argues the Rambam. However, the Ramban replies and says, no, the Chumash does not give the last word to Shimon and Levi. In fact, Yaakov did not agree with Shimon and Levi's argument. And Yaakov held his tongue, but not forever. At the end of his life, Yaakov is critical of Shimon and Levi. He says on his deathbed, Shimon Levi Achim, Klei Chamas Mecharitzehem, they are violent. And he is critical of them. He's upset at the violent actions of Shimon and Levi. The Ramban says that Yaakov Avinu is criticizing Shimon and Levi for their actions at Shechem. So it seems clear that from the Ramban's perspective, that the Chumash concludes that Shimon and Levi were wrong in their actions in Shechem by attacking non-combatants, and Shimon and Levi are criticized for what they did. What would the Rambam respond? The Rambam would respond that who says that Yaakov Avinu was criticizing Shimon and Levi for what they did in Shechem? Perhaps that Yaakov Avinu is criticizing Shimon and Levi for their participation in or leading role in the sale of Yosef. Chazal teach that Shimon and Levi were the leaders in the sale of Yosef. So that's the Ramban wouldn't agree with that. He says the Machlokas Ram and Ramban in this particular section in Bereishit Perek Mem Tet is whether Yaakov is criticizing Shimon and Levi for their actions in Shechem or the actions by Mechiriyat Yosef. It's not very clear in the Chumash. And the bottom line, what emerges from this discussion? No conclusion either way. We find that on one hand, and you can criticize Shimon. You can criticize Shimon and Levi for what they did, and defend Shimon and Levi for what they did with did in Shechem. The dispute, the machlokas between Ram and the Ramban remains unresolved. So, what kind of ramifications does this have for Israeli actions in Jenin and southern Lebanon? So far, none. We cannot draw a conclusion from Shimon and Levi, because we do not know if they acted properly. But we do have a very interesting opinion of the Maharal. The Maharal's about, this is the Maharal's opinion is going to be our focus, really, for the rest of the evening. The Maharal argues as follows. He, on one hand, he agrees with Ramban. He agrees that the members of Shechem, the residents of Shechem, are not held responsible for the actions that their leader did. You can't hold people who are responsible for the violent actions of their leaders. How can they stop them? They're unused. They have no choice. So says Maharal. But on the other hand, he agrees with the Rambam that Shimon and Levi were correct. Why? The Ramban defends Shimon and Levi's attack on the people of Shechem for the following. He says that during a war, that one is allowed to engage in combat not only the people who attacked you, but also the entire nation. And because Shimon and the Ramara points out that it was not that when the abduction of Dina was not a matter of personal, a private action by Shechem and Hamor alone, but rather it was the action of a nation, and as a nation, one that attack that other nation, were not only permitted to or obligated to attack those people. Rabbi Gruska, I'll respond to you in just a second. So it's an interesting point. Okay. Hold on just one second. That the Maharam believes that if we are attacked by another nation, that we are permitted to respond to that nation, and one is allowed to respond not only to those who attack us, but to the entire nation. All right, so I see that Rabbi Gruskot has posed a question regarding can Shimon HaLevi be compared to Tzahal, right? That's right. That one of the criticisms that Ramban has about Shimon HaLevi, who gave Shimon HaLevi the right to attack, the authority to attack the people of Shechem, that would have been Yaakov's choice. And Yaakov did not want the attack to happen, but the IDF, or certainly the Israeli army, are the ones that do have this right to an obligation to defend the people of their country and attack those who attacked us. The morale say not just to attack those, but the entire nation who attack us. Okay. Now the morale points out that this is not just we don't just find this by the Shimon and Levi's actions by Shechem. We find this later in the Chumash. Ramidian as well backed us with the story of Benod Moab and with the hiring of Bil'an. And when we attack the Midianim, we not only attack we actually wipe out all of the males and most of the females of Midian, even those who were not involved in attacking us. So we see that when attacked by a particular nation, that we respond not only to those who are attacking us directly, but to any member of that nation. Now, to help understand modern terms, let's take this. Let's bring this to the actions at the United States Army. Let's say during World War II, the British Army during World War II, when the United States attacked and bombed Hiroshima and bombed Nagasaki, what right did they have to do that? After all, the people in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, especially the babies, the old elderly, they weren't involved in the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor. They weren't attacking Americans. What right did the Americans have to attack the Japanese, these innocent Japanese civilians? The answer is, these are unfortunately innocent Japanese civilians, but nevertheless, since they are members of an aggressor nation, the Maharal would say that if you're attacked by a nation that's attacked, is allowed to respond to the entire nation. And similarly, to the Nazis, the bombing of Dresden during World War II, that unfortunately there were Germans, young babies, elderly people, women that were not involved in harming anybody, but nevertheless, they bore the brunt of the attack on the Allied from the Allied attack on Germany because of the poor behavior of their leaders. Such is the sad price and tragic price that one pays for being a member of an aggressor. How can you compare the kidnapping of two soldiers with Hitler and Japan? The attack, because it's one to say clearly, the attacking of two soldiers was an attack on the entire country. And I think, actually, quite frankly, that it's that the Israeli army was far more justified than the World War II, because the Americans during World War II were attacking civilians, whereas the Israelis were attacking terrorists and unfortunately sometimes hitting civilians as well as terrorists, especially because the terrorists embed themselves among civilians. So I think Israel has the upper hand. So honestly, the kidnapping of two soldiers would be quite similar to the attack to the kidnapping of just one person, Dina. And even those who are critical of Shimon and Levi at Shechem, non-combatants after the battle is done, after Dina's already been rescued, while the Israelis are attacking the Hezbollah and not civilians while the soldiers are still in captivity. Does worldview of Israel's killing civilians play a factor? It might. We can talk about it in the end, but the worldview, I think a decent moral person would, okay, hold on one second, okay. The worldview, I think, does certainly play a role, but I think the worldview has to be fair of Israel and understand, just like we understand, most people would look at the Allied behavior during World War II to be acceptable behavior, and Israel is allowed to defend itself. Lo b'koch, lo b'chai, lo ela b'ruchi, what I've heard the pshat is, it's not only koch, not only chai, but also b'ruach. Okay, let's go ahead. Israel is allowed to defend itself. So the Rambam not only has about a halachos of tefillah, the Rambam also has halachos for milchamos, because we're supposed to, unfortunately, there is 8 milchamot and 8 shalom, not only ruchi. Okay, next. If we can try to support the opinion of the Maharal. The Maharal, we find, we can try to support him from the Radak in Sefer Divrei Yamim. We find the Radak is struggling with a very difficult pasuk in Divrei Yamim, which tells us that David HaMelech is forbidden to, David HaMelech was forbidden to build the Beis HaMikdash, his lifelong dream. Why? Yadecha damim milehu, because his hands were filled with blood. Now that's a very puzzling pasuk. Why in the world should he be disqualified for building the Beis HaMikdash? He didn't, because of blood in his hand. He had no unjust, offhand, he would seem to have no unjustified blood in his hand. Now, one could interpret that speaking about Uriah Achiti, very possibly, those who interpret it that way. But the Radak says that what the Pasuk is referring to as follows. Says that David HaMelech was not able to build the Beis HaMikdash because of the civilians that he killed during battle. And the Radak writes that David HaMelech was justified in killing people, Shalai Yubnei Milchato, people who were non-combatants. That's acceptable. Why? Ki kavanato l'chalot harasha'im. His intention was to eliminate the evil doers, Shalai Yifritzu b'Yisrael, that they should not attack Jews. And this was, however, he's not able to, it's justified killing, but it was not considered to be a sin, but he would be disqualified from building the Beis HaMikdash. We see from here that it's acceptable and perhaps permissible, even obligated, one is permitted, or perhaps even obligated, to eliminate the cost of sometimes having to wound or even kill people who are lo b'nei milchamto. Okay, that is that's the proof in the Radak. Now we find also in a Haftarah that we'll be reading in a few weeks, that before Shaul HaMelech is about to attack Amalek, he issued a warning to the peace of the Keni, and he says to the Keni, who are at peace with us and not part of Amalek, but they're living in close proximity to Amalek, that he warned them, please move away from Amalek, because when I'm going to be attacking Amalek, if you don't move away, you also are running the risk of being included in the attack. So we see that Shaul HaMelech gives warning to the Keni, and he asks them to leave. But had the Keni not left, it seems pretty clear that Shaul HaMelech would have been willing to attack not only Amalek, but also the Keni who were embedded together with Amalek. And we see here the same idea that in waging war, that it's considered to be acceptable and tolerable to affect those innocent civilians who also find themselves together with the enemy. Okay, now another question that was asked is that people, what about is question of the worldview that Natan raised. Let's talk a little bit about the Maharal and the Geneva Convention. I'm not an expert in international law, but I will say one thing, and a point that's made in terms of, let's say, assuming that Israel is halakhically obligated to honor the Geneva Convention, which one can make a good argument that you could say that Israel is obligated to honor international law. Perhaps you can apply the rule of Dina Machusa Dina, that we follow the law of the land in which we reside. Perhaps that would obligate Israel to follow international law. That, nevertheless, when it comes to following the Geneva Convention, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, a major Israeli rabbi, once pointed out that a very fundamental point, that when what is the idea of following, let's say, Dina Machusa Dina? You follow not necessarily the letter of the law, but how it's practiced. So, for example, a story is told about Rav Avraham Kotler. He was once traveling along the New Jersey Turnpike many years ago, and over 40 years ago, and his students was driving him, and he was going a little bit over the speed, a few miles over the speed limit. And Rav Kotler said, "No, you can't go over the speed limit." And the Talmud priest, the student, replied, "No, they don't give you a ticket till about 62, 63. Rav Avraham Kotler asked the student to flag down a police person, and he stopped a policeman, and Rabbi Kotler asked the policeman, "When do you start giving a ticket?" And the policeman said, "We don't give a ticket until one is driving 63. So at that point, Rav Kotler said, "You can drive at 62, even though the signs, the speed limit's posted 55, but if in practice they tolerate up to 62, then that's acceptable." So one could argue that we follow the Geneva Convention as it's practiced, and the practice is, we saw in World War II, as I mentioned, that unfortunately sometimes I just got distracted by the question. Simcha, I'll try to respond to you to finish this point. That we follow the Geneva Convention as it's practiced. Those examples of Allied behavior during World War I, World War II. And I'll just add that the policy during the Cold War of mutually assured destruction, that the United States was attacked the Soviet Union with nuclear weapons, if, God forbid, the Soviets would have attacked us with nuclear weapons. And there, it was clearly the United States was willing to harm civilians as well as combatants. Okay, the question is that whether to honor the convention is not a halakhic question, but a political one. I'm not sure if that's correct, because the Torah requires Israel to honor. One is that Israel concludes, that Jews have concluded with the nations, and the example, a classic example, would be the treaty that we concluded with the Givonim in the book of Yoshua. We find the Rambam writes in Hilchos Melachim that we are obligated to honor the treaty with the Givonim, so too we're obligated to honor a treaty. The Geneva Convention would seem to be included in that. So it would be, to make a good argument that it's a halachic obligation to uphold it, but nevertheless the Maharal seems to be in harmony with the Geneva Convention. Now, as the question that we quote from a pasuk in Sefer Shmuel, the question is, there any halachic support from the Maharal from halachic sources? So I'd like to quote to you a point from Rav Yisraeli and Rav Shechter. Rav Herschel Shechter, Rav Shaul Yisraeli from Israel, Zatzal, Rav Yisraeli, pointed out that we do not find at any point that we do not find that there's any chiyuv to distinguish between dam ladam, to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants, as long as we're engaged in a justified war as long as it is otherwise impossible to spare the civilians. In other words, in order to wage war properly, we need to kill civilians. Unfortunately, that may be necessary, and the Torah never obligates us to make that distinction when we wage war. That's the argument of Rabbi Yisraeli from Silence. But Rav Shechter makes a different argument. Rav Shechter makes the argument that a very basic fundamental argument, that when a leader of a country takes a nation out to leave it to risk his own people, we find that the Gemara in Shavuot tells us that Malchusa de Kabachad Mishita Lomayensha, that a king leading his people to war, even if he loses up to one-sixth of the population in an attempt to save the residents of his country, to save his own population, that would be acceptable because he's risking people, his smaller amount of people in order to preserve the nation on the whole. So if we're allowed to wage war and risk the lives of our own people, so too we'd be able to risk the lives amidst our enemies, because unfortunately that's a part of the price that one pays, that one is being in proximity to people who are attacking us. So that is the argument of Rav Shechter. Okay, so we've seen that we can support the Maharal and Tanakh and Halakhic arguments as well. As we all know, this is not the policy of the IDF. That's correct, Rabbi Kalman. This is not the policy of the IDF. The IDF, we will actually, let me try to come back. And to a certain extent, the IDF, it's impossible to avoid any civilian casualties, certainly in the current circumstances. And the IDF takes extraordinary steps to try to avoid civilian casualties. But from time to time, as we remember from Jenin in 2006, and even recently in operations in Gaza, it's almost inevitable it's going to happen, especially because the terrorists are embedding themselves amongst civilians and using civilians as human shields, which I might add is a violation of the Geneva Convention. Okay, so the Israeli army does wage the war, so to a great extent the Israeli army is following the approach of the Maharal. Now, let's go now to, on the handout, let's go to section 5. Let's start talking about applying the Maharal to the current situation. Is the struggle against terrorism, is it part of the war? It's not a conventional war. We call that terrorism. So to this, Rav Shechter replies by citing a story involving Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was consulted in September of 1970 about the following anguishing problem. There was a famous hijacking Black September, right before Black September, September of 1970. It was a plane flying from Israel was hijacked to Jordan. And on that plane was the famous Rav Yitzchak Kuttner. And Rav Kuttner's Talmidim raised the possibility that they should raise a huge amount of money in order to redeem Rav Kuttner. Now, even though halachically we're not supposed to pay a high price to ransom soldiers, Jews who are held by terrorists, nevertheless, Tosfos writes in Gittin, Maseches Gittin, that if it's an outstanding Talmid Chacham, one could pay a great price to redeem a captive. And the response that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky issued in 1970 was that the Tosfos gives us permission only in times of peace, but not in times of war. In times of war, you can't even ransom an incredibly great Talmid Chacham, an outstanding Talmid Chacham. You can't ransom them, even such a great Talmid Chacham. Cannot. Why? It's the time of war, and that would harm the Jewish side. Similarly, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky felt that it's an interesting perspective that he has on terrorist attacks on Israel. He believes that the terrorist attacks of Israel are basically a continuation of the war against us in 1948, which he already said in 1970 that The war has continued nonstop from 1940. The war continues, and because we're at war, we were not allowed to ransom Rav Yitzchak Putner. And Rav Herschel Schachter believes that the Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's policy or evaluation would apply to this very day. So yes, we can argue that we are involved in war. But what's the more difficult problem is that when we quote the Maharal, the Maharal is saying that by members of the nation, we're allowed to reply and respond to all the members. Here's the question. Are the Palestinians defined as a nation? Are they a nation that are attacking us? So one thing that will say the people of Shechem, the people of Midian, they're all one nation. But here, one could argue it's not the Palestinian nation that are attacking us. These are us. And that's a very serious question. So we'd like to respond to that on two levels. Perhaps you could say that the situation in Gaza now, where the Palestinians have attacked where the Palestinians have attacked have elected Hamas to be the leaders to be their leaders. Clearly, they've chosen a terrorist organization, a nation, an organization in its charter on its website calls for the destruction of the state of Israel, and therefore you could say that Hamas's war against Eretz, against Israel, is not just waged by a group of individual terrorists, but by all the Palestinians in Gaza. Perhaps you can make that argument, and perhaps one could make that argument also not only but in the West Bank as well, that the Palestinian nation, unfortunately, Palestinian people, fighting against the entire nation, perhaps. But what becomes more difficult, what about the Hezbollah that have lodged themselves in southern Lebanese people are not attacking the state of Israel. So what right does Israel have to harm, to risk the lives of civilians in their response to Hezbollah? So I think the answer to that would be as follows. That perhaps we can broaden the idea of the Maharal, especially based on the Radak that we quoted, and based on the based on Shaul HaMelech. Remember, Shaul HaMelech says to the Canaanite, a different nation than Amalek, leave the Amalek, evacuate Amalek, stay away from them. So perhaps what the idea is that when one has to wage war, and the waging of war. We have to wage war properly. And waging war properly involves, unfortunately, risking of lives of civilians who are living near, we don't have to be limited to the Maharal. We can risk civilians who are not only members of the nation, of the same nation that's attacking us, as the United States did against the Japanese, but also we have to be willing to harm those who are living among these, just as the Shaul HaMelech would have been willing to harm the Kenai had they not evacuated their positions of being located so close to Amalek. Okay, now what I just said now, the idea of waging war properly, the Rav Herschel Schachter's idea, unfortunately this contrast with the Israeli Supreme Court. This is that Rabbi Kalman raised very well, that this is not Israel's policy, but the Israeli Supreme Court's view of morality is that democracy requires one to fight terrorism with one hand tied behind one's back, which one could argue is not the correct way, but as we're going to try to emphasize, that it's not only a justified war, but as I heard from Rav Yuval Sharlov pointed out, that it's the halachic and ethical obligation to win a war. And this is something Rav Sharlov pointed out, that he feels that in the IDF, the Israeli army's moral code, has something missing. The moral code is missing the moral obligation to win the war, not just in our interest, but it's a halachic and moral obligation that one who is waging war is involved, lo saman dam riyaka, but saving lives. Just as a response to Simcha, none of the Rabbanim are experts in what is the correct way of running a war. The Rabbanim, the Rav, the particular Rav that I just quoting now, Rav Yuval Sharlov, also was learned in a yeshivat hezder, and a hezder yeshiva in Israel, and he was an officer in the Israeli army, and is one of the reasons why the Israeli army will consult him about these issues. And there's no doubt, I really should emphasize that Simcha does have an important point that the correct way of running a war is certainly not the province of the Rabbanim. The Rabbanim are not going to decide how to the proper way to run a war. That is with certainly for military experts. But for the moral issues, that's certainly for the Rabbanim to be the ones doing to make that kind of decision. Certainly, to be together with ideally, what should be done is military experts making the military decisions / ethical decisions. Am I expressing questions and raising? Am I expressing a political view and seeking Mikarot to justify it? Well, I think hopefully at the end of the decision, I think that perhaps you would think otherwise. Let's continue here with source number 5. Here's really the key issue. And really, I think anyone within the mainstream of Israeli society, being from the left to the right, understand that Israel sometimes has to risk killing civilians while defending. I think there's a strong consensus of Israel in Israel to that point. However, where there's machlokas amongst Rabbanim is what about risking the lives of Israeli soldiers in order to reduce enemy what happened in Jenin and what happened in southern Lebanon? Here you have a serious machlokas. Whose sons and grandsons, I believe, at this point, are already serving in the Israeli army. Rav Lichtenstein believes that morally, that we should risk a small amount of our soldiers of our own soldiers in order to reduce Arab casualties. I agree with Rabbi Kalman. And that's Rav Lichtenstein's argument. However, other Rabbanim, such as Rav Lior from Kiryat Arba, Rav Yaakov Ariel from Ramat Gan, and many other Rabbanim as well, Rav Shapira, they believe that risk the lives of Israeli soldiers in order to reduce enemy casualties, because they say they make the, and then the argument is made as follows. I've seen from an interesting professor near the professor Eliyahu Shochetman, he points out as follows. Points out that the Radvaz, which is accepted l'halacha, cited in poskim such as Rav Moshe Feinstein and other Rabbanim, that we are not permitted to put ourselves at risk in order to save somebody else's life. Even to save somebody else from certain death, we're not allowed to put ourselves at grave risk. And for the Israeli army, Professor Shochetman argues, to put all the Israeli soldiers at risk, to all these Israeli soldiers who are attacking Jenin by foot and going into the camp trying to eliminate the terrorists house to house, why should we put our soldiers at risk in order to save others, to save the enemy, the civilian casualties. The civilians, unfortunately, it's tragic, it's sad, but nevertheless, despite that, we are not allowed to risk our own people. So argues Professor Shochetman. But this is a this remains an unresolved machlokes. My own reading of speaking to various rabbanim, of speaking to Rav Herschel Schechter, of Mordechai Willig, and Rav Bleich here in America, and also Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg in Israel, my sense is that the consensus opinion of the rabbanim in Eretz Israel is not like Rav Lichtenstein, but rather they feel that the Israeli army acted improperly in Jenin by risking Israeli soldiers, and the loss, they felt the loss of the Israeli, of 13 Israeli soldiers in Jenin was inexcusable. They should have attacked from the air, especially due to the fact that the Israeli army had issued a warning to civilians to evacuate the area of Jenin. Okay. Let's now move on to section 6 and talk about some of the ethical obligation to win a justified war. I'd like to point out an interesting Ramban. Ramban writes that we have to count in the minyan mitzvot, we have to count the obligation that the Midrash records, that when waging war, we're supposed to leave one side open. That we siege not on all four sides, but you attack on three sides and you leave one side open. And the Ramban writes that there are two reasons for this. Reason number one is that we we want to have rachmanis on our enemy. We want to give them the chance to escape. The second reason is that it's in our interest to give them an opportunity to escape, because if we give them an opportunity to escape, then they feel like they're fighting to the death, and they're going to fight like a crazed bear, like a dov shakul. And so therefore, by giving them the out, you're not backing them up literally against the wall, you're giving them an out literally, and therefore they would be fight less fiercely. So our question is, why does the Ramban have to give two explanations for this obligation to leave the open the four sides? First of all, it's mercy, it's also self-interest. So my suggestion perhaps is when does the halakha require us to have mercy on the enemy? That's only when it does not conflict with our self-interest, and not only our self-interest, but rather with our moral, ethical obligation to win a justified war. And when we're engaged in a moral, justified war, and there's no other way to properly wage a battle other than by risking the lives of civilians, then our own moral obligation to win the war, it takes precedence over the lives of civilians who find themselves in proximity to our enemies. Now, I've been critical of the Israeli action in Jenin. I would, however, like to quote from Rav Plank a possible justification for the Israeli actions and Jenin, and that is as follows. That he points out that a government has the right to risk individual members of the was the reason the IDF went to have because of world view. If they went in because of world view, it's hard to imagine that 13 soldiers' lives are more important than some of these people are fathers. Some believe fathers of families, the sons, 13 families, not just 13 individuals that were killed, which is so incredibly sad. But if their concern was as follows, that if there were Israel would have bombed the Jenin from the air, and that would have caused an outcry on the Arab street, and there would have been pressure on Arab governments to attack us and wage war. Therefore, one could argue that the Israeli government has the right to risk and even lose the lives of 13 soldiers in the short run in order to reduce our own losses in the long run. because if the Arabs, God forbid, would have waged war, been pressured to wage an outright war against us, that would have caused us to lose far more than 13 soldiers. So perhaps you can have such justification, and the basis for such an approach perhaps would be the Gemara in Shavuos that we quoted earlier, that a king, a government leader that causes a sixth of the population to be lost in war is justified if what they're doing is to try to protect the long-term interests of the nation of the whole. So perhaps this is one way for which we can justify the Israeli actions at Jenin. The bottom line, our conclusion, is that that yes, we have the opinion of Rav Lichtenstein that would seem to justify what happened in Jenin and what happened and as well as what happened in southern Lebanon as well, in order to reduce the Israeli soldiers. The civilian casualties. Rav Lichtenstein would justify it, but most Rabbanim would not justify it. Would say that we're not allowed to risk Israeli soldiers' lives in an effort to reduce civilian casualties. So we have to wage war properly, and in that case in Gaza, that the proper thing would be to attack the taxi. And in fact, just to tell you what happened in that case, in that taxi in Gaza, of the Rabbi Sharla, with his opinion, he's a student of Rav Lichtenstein, he felt as follows. He said, as long as there were no children in that taxi in Gaza, he said, then attack and destroy that entire cab. Perhaps he felt that the cab driver, as an adult, bore some of the responsibility for the terrorism that is going on in Gaza. As long as there were no children, he gave the go-ahead to eliminate, and that's what was done. That taxi actually was destroyed, and that terrorist was eliminated. Okay, we're gonna wrap up, and I see the comments. I want to respond, and they're good points. I just want to comment with an end on with my last point. I think it's very important for the State of Israel. It seems to be sometimes missing, and I think that it's important for all Jews to realize that we have to have a moral self-confidence and strength about our conflict with the Arabs. I think that it's important to Megillat Esther. Megillat Esther, you find that that the word ra is not used until the seventh parak. Everything is tov. Tov, tov, tov. Melech tov, yikasev la'adam. It's good to destroy the Jews. In the eyes of even of Achashverosh, not only Haman, everything is good. There's moral relativism. But as soon as the tide changed, and when the tide changed in Megillat Esther, when Esther had the courage to point up and say, Haman hara azeh, that Haman is evil, and I think it's important in the Arab-Israeli conflict for us to have the confidence and realize that Israel has been willing so many times to compromise and make peace with the Arabs, starting from the Peel Partition Plan in 1937, the UN Partition Plan in 1947, after 67 to make peace, and in Camp David, the incredible, the stunning offers that the Ehud Barak was willing to make for peace. Israel's been the one that's been willing to make peace, and the reason for the wars against Israel has clearly been the Arab unwillingness to make a compromise with us. So that's an important point to realize, that our wars are justified, and our response to the Arabs are morally justified, they're halakhically justified. You have to, but then the question that really, in terms of that's the moral issue, then the question, the practical issue that people are raising, that I see that Ms. Adams is raising, perhaps responding with force would decrease terrorism. Okay, that's a good question. That's something that that political and military leaders have to figure out, well, what is the best way to reduce terrorism? And then also, Simcha is raising a very serious issue that Israel does not necessarily have a free hand, because Israel is still, for better or for worse, is still dependent on the United States support. And if it acts in a way that would we do have to consider the fact that Israel's survival would be put at great risk if the United States, if we would antagonize the United States and they would stop sending us aid or weapons. I would say that Simcha, I think it's important to be very, very clear that the Israeli government has consistently, for the last, Israeli government and representatives for the last 71 years, going back to the Field Partition Plan, has been willing to compromise, and the Arab leadership has, maybe there are individual Arabs that are willing to compromise, but the Arab leadership has consistently, for the last 71 years, been the ones who have been unwilling to compromise. Israel has been dibur al maaseh. I think it's clear that Israel has been very willing to make compromise. Just take a look at Gaza, even unilateral withdrawal. So Israel definitely has the moral upper hand. Okay, I think that's I've wrapped up the evening. Thank you very, very much for joining us. Thank you to Rabbi Kellerman for this incredibly wonderful program. The ability to be able to share Torah and learning Torah with so many people in so many different places at once. Thank you all of us who joined us, and what better way to celebrate the upcoming 60th anniversary of the creation of the State of Israel with a discussion of some of the vital halachic issues that are facing the State of Israel. We're going to discuss next week an issue that faces us, and that is, are we Jews living in the diaspora, living outside of Eretz Yisrael, are we obligated to make Aliyah? Have a very, very good night.